Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here today, and it's also a pleasure to visit some place that's actually slightly colder than Chicago. And I've really enjoyed it. It's been a very fun day. So I want to talk about our work on bicontinuous interfaces, and this is work that was done with a graduate student, Young-Woo Kwon, who is now at Samsung, Katsuyo Thornton, who's at the University of Michigan. So let me first set the stage, and my apologies for the experts in the audience a bit, so that everyone is on the same page. What I'm going to be talking about here is coarsening in a generic sense, but let me give you an example of what it happens in a very specific case where you take a mixture of two phases. So these little white dots here are solid particles. They are embedded in a liquid. These happen to be tin particles in a lead-tin eutectic liquid. And you hold this system isothermal, and lo and behold, the structure changes as a function of time. What happens is that material leaves the small particles and it gets transported through the liquid to the big particles, and these ones disappear and the large ones grow. And the overall driving force here is to decrease the interfacial area per unit volume. The reason why this occurs is that the concentration at the surface of a particle depends upon the mean curvature. And so curvature of interfaces, as you'll see, is something that's very important in understanding these processes, but it's a thread that runs through the entire talk here. This is the capillary length, which is related to the interfacial energy. And phi zero here is just a constant of what the concentration is at a planar interface. So high curvature regions have high concentrations, low curvature regions have low concentrations, and hence material flows from high to low, causing the small ones to disappear. So one of the interesting things about this process is that it exhibits an interesting self-organizational character. So these are some experiments where we have looked at the coarsening process again, like I showed you before, but at a higher volume fraction of solid. We've fixed the magnification here. And so it's a very complicated process here. You have this particle, which might be shrinking with respect to this one, but this one might be growing with respect to this one. It's a very complicated mass transport process. But if you scale the magnification of each one of these micrographs by the average particle size, which changes at each one of these times, you get pictures that look like this down here. And so the system, even though you have this very complicated mass transport process driven by curvature, self-organizes into a unique state when you scale things by the time-dependent length scale, in this case, the average particle size. And so we want to address this scaling issue because what it says is that any system, regardless of what the initial conditions are, regardless of how you processed it, you wait long enough, and it's going to assume this unique time-independent form when you scale things by the average particle size. The systems we're interested in here are far more complicated, however, and they are topologically and morphologically more complicated than simple spheres. So this is a two-phase mixture of polymer blends that comes out of Janai's group. Shows the complicated interconnected structure. This is what you would see in an order disorder transformation or maybe a magnetic material where you have domains of different order between one phase and another. And we want to understand how these structures coarsen. Clearly, there's going to be curvature in the system that's going to cause these domains to evolve in a certain way. But the question here is, do we see the same sort of self-organization? Do we see the same sort of universality as we did in the spherical particle case? And if you look right in the middle here, there's a hole. So these structures are so sufficiently complicated that they have actual holes in the interfaces. So what is the way we're going to describe this process? Well, we're going to look at something called the Kahn-Hilliard equation. It's a very simple partial differential equation that describes the evolution of these interfaces. And the idea here is you take a material at some high temperature and you cool it into a two-phase region. Composition is a function of temperature, and you phase separate into a low composition phase and a high composition phase. If you normalize these compositions from 0 to 1, you get a free energy curve that looks something like that, classical double well free energy, that has minima at one composition and minimum at the other. And the free energy of a system that exhibits this type of phase separation can be described by an integral over the volume of a free energy density that varies with position because you have phases of different order parameter, and a gradient energy coefficient times the norm of the gradient. So let me describe what I mean by that. So let's say you took a phase of, you have a system with phase of order parameter 1 in contact with a phase of order parameter 0. And I asked you a question, how do you minimize this functional subject to the constraint that these two phases actually exist? It's a kind of cheating to get rid of one of the phases. So you have two phases. Well, if you think about what minimizes this function, which is given over here, this free energy density, it's pretty clear that what you would like to do is to sit most of the time in this bottom of this well, and sit most of the time in the bottom of that well. And that's what you get when you have completely uniform concentration up to the interface and completely uniform concentration over there. So you have a step change in concentration. If you include this term, however, that penalizes gradients, and it says that the system doesn't like to have an infinite gradient at a given location, and so what happens is that there's a trade-off between what minimizes this term, which is the step function, and what minimizes this term, which is a flat line, and you get a diffuse interface between the two phases. And so what we do is this: the partial differential equations that we derive from this energy functional are valid in every position in space, and we can follow the evolution of interfaces, where interfaces in this case are defined as a value defined where the order parameter, for example, is equal to a half. So it would be right there. Okay. So how do you get the kinetics from that energy functional? It's really pretty simple. You know that the flux is given by the gradients in a chemical potential. The chemical potential is the variational derivative of the free energy with respect to the order parameter, which is just this, if you do the simple algebra. You put this into there, and you get an expression for the flux. Mass is conserved in the system, so the net result is that the time derivative of the order parameter goes like a mobility times the Laplacian of a chemical potential, generalized chemical potential. This is called the Kahn-Hilliard equation in the literature. And the interesting thing is if you take that equation and you do some matched asymptotics, you say that the thickness of the interface times the mean curvature is much, much less than 1, you get diffusion equations in the bulk with these Gibbs-Thompson equations at the interface. So you go back to that problem I just showed you at the beginning with the spherical particles, where the concentrations go like the mean curvature. And you have diffusion of the of mass or order parameter from one phase to another. And the velocity at a point on the interface is related to gradients in the order parameter at the interface times the diffusion coefficient. The key takeaway message from this slide is that in the Kahn-Hilliard case, they're diffusional interactions between the interface. You have an interface here, and it knows that another one exists over here because you have diffusional transport between one phase and the other. I want to contrast to that what you get in a magnetic system or order disorder systems. This is from a material, iron aluminum, that has different order as you go across an antiphase domain boundary. You'll see this in magnetic materials. This would be a spin up, and that would be spin down. You can describe the evolution of these boundaries using precisely the same formulation. And just to keep life simple, we're going to use exactly the same free energy functional, exactly the same bulk free energy, and write the free energy as a function of position using that free energy there. You get the chemical potential is the variational derivative, which is this, but the order parameter is not conserved. There is no reason for all the spin. There is a constraint on the total amount of spin up or spin down in the system if it's not in a magnetic field. So it's unconstrained. You can have unlimited amounts of spin up and spin down. It's not conserved. So the variation of the order parameter is just given by a mobility times the deviation of the chemical potential from some reference. And so you get this equation, which looks exactly like the Kahn-Hilliard equation, except you don't have the Laplacian sitting there. Okay? So you go from something that's fourth order in space for the Kahn-Hilliard equation to something that's second order in space for the Allen-Kahn equation. And that gives rise to different interfacial kinetics. So if you look at the sharp interface limit, or the limit where the thickness is much, much smaller than the curvature, you get that the velocity at a point on the interface goes like a constant times the mean curvature. So this is completely local. If I give you the curvature, mean curvature at an interface, you know precisely what the velocity, local normal velocity is at that point. You don't have to solve any diffusion equation. There's no long-range communication between interfaces. And so the question we want to ask here is, given that these bicontinuous interfaces develop, how does the fact that you have a local evolution law as opposed to a non-local evolution law affect the coarsening process? And so what we do here is we're looking at late stages, so we're just looking at coarsening. We begin with random noise. I'll show you some results where we relax this assumption, but we start off with the first ones. I'll show you where the volume fraction of each phase is a half. The phases coarsen, grow, appear, and coarsen, and we look at this limit. And we want to be sure we're in the limit where the interfaces are small compared to the mean curvature, so that we're definitely in this coarsening regime. Relatively simple numerical technique. We use a parallel code that runs over 32 processors or so. But because we're looking at this coarsening process, we need large systems and long times, and we use relatively large grids, 1024 grids, cubed grids for the Allen-Kahn equation, and that means a single run generates about a half a terabyte worth of data. So we have a data analysis problem to deal with as well, how to handle all of this stuff. So this is the kind of structures you get in three dimensions. So you take a system, you quench it into the two-phase region, and you end up with this very complicated bicontinuous structure. And if you hold that as a function of time, the structure coarsens. So it goes from something that looks like that to that. And it coarsens, as you'd expect. So the system's minimizing the total interfacial energy per unit volume. To give you an idea how complicated this structure looks, really is, you take a small section of that, and you just look through the structure, and just look at the interfaces. And this is what I mean by a topologically complicated structure. So the interfaces are completely interconnected. There are no independent domains in the structure. The curvatures are both positive and negative. There are holes in the structure. And one of the things that we were faced with when we first got this picture is, how do we quantify this? You can't measure an average particle size, right? That's pretty obvious. And so how do we understand even what the morphology of this structure really is? And the way we did that is by going into the structure and measuring the mean and Gauss curvature at a given point in the structure. So we break the structure up into small patches, which is easy to do these days because everything is it's on a grid to begin with. And you measure the principal curvatures, kappa 1 and kappa 2, where for the definition that we'll use, kappa 2 is always greater than kappa 1. And the invariants of the curvature tensor at that particular point are the mean curvature and the Gauss curvature. So the mean curvature, which is the sum of the two principal curvatures, this is what drives the coarsening process. This is the chemical potential. The other invariant, which is very important, as you'll see, is the Gauss curvature, Gaussian curvature, which is the product of the two. So this is unrelated to the thermodynamics. This, in a certain sense, comes along for the ride, but it's a very important ingredient, as you'll see, as to what happens to the structure. And the way to see that is to look at the Gaussian curvature as a function of position. So this is the Kahn-Hilliard case. Negative Gaussian curvature is black to this light green. Positive Gaussian curvature is from here over to red. And if you look at that structure, it's pretty clear. There's almost no positive Gaussian curvature here. And so that means almost all the Gaussian curvature here involves patches of interface with principal curvatures of opposite sign. And those are surfaces that look like saddles. So this structure immediately produces a whole plethora of saddle-shaped surfaces. The only place where you see positive Gaussian curvature, which are things that look like hemispheres, for example, positive or negative Gaussian curvature, positive Gaussian curvature of principal curvatures of different signs, is where you have pinching events that occur occasionally in the structure. So what we do is we compute the principal curvatures as a function of position, and then compute the probability of finding a patch of interface with a given pair of principal curvatures. And as I'll show you that in a second. So we need a Lang scale in order to quantify the coarsening process here. For the spherical particle case, we used average particle size. That's easy to measure. Here, we're going to use 1 over the surface area per unit volume. So that's a Lang scale. So surface area goes like Lang squared. Volume goes like length cubed. So that's a length as a function of t to the 1/3. This tracks, interestingly enough, the total interfacial energy in the structure, or the total interfacial area as well. So as you look at this as a function of t to the 1/3 during this Kahn-Hilliard conserved order parameter case, you have a nice straight line, as you would expect. And the important thing I want to point out here is that during the coarsening process, in our simulations, the average size scale goes from something on the order of 6 to something on the order of 30 in these dimensionless units, or about a factor of 5. So we can kind of see, for those of you who are familiar with this, whether or not we're in the scaling regime. We have enough dynamical range in this variable here. So you have a nice straight line. And what I want to do is I want to show you data at each of these times in order to understand how this process evolves. Okay, so this is one of these probability plots. So this is probability, low probability, high probability, kappa 1 and kappa 2. So we go through the structure, and we measure the principal curvatures of a patch. We go to another place, we measure the principal curvatures of another patch, and we compute the probability of finding patches of a given pair of principal curvatures, kappa 2 and kappa 1. All the principal curvatures have to lie to the left of this dashed line by our convention. This is zero mean curvature right here, this dashed line. And these are curvatures where you have Gauss curvature of positive. These are spherical patches along here and cylindrical patches along here where one of the principal curvatures are zero. So you start off at early time and it looks like this. Slightly later, it looks like that. And you can see what's happening. This probability is moving down towards this origin here of zero principal curvature kappa 1 and zero principal curvature kappa 2 as time goes on. Okay, so now let's see what happens if I scale these principal curvatures by this time-dependent length. So we're going to do the same thing we did with those pictures I showed you at the beginning of lead tin. Remember, I changed the magnification depending upon the average particle size, and all these pictures self-organized into this unique shape, unique particle size distribution. We're going to test the same thing here, except for these bicontinuous structures, where I scale the curvature by this time-dependent length and see whether this probability distribution scales as well. In other words, it becomes time-independent. So this is at 5,000. That's 14,000. My student was deathly afraid at the huge changes in these things as a function of time. But by my eye, they're pretty much the same. So, in fact, they don't change very much. And that is the unique interface shape distribution that characterizes a conserved order parameter coarsening process. So any bicontinuous structure with 50-50 volume fraction of each of the phases will coarse into this unique interface shape distribution. So let me talk about this a bit to give you the physical understanding of what's going on here. So there's a peak here right along h equals 0, and it's symmetric about h equals 0, and that's because it's a 50-50 distribution of phases, 50% alpha, 50% beta. So it's symmetric about this line, and there's a peak right there at along h equals 0. So it's symmetric about that line. Almost all the shapes are in this region where one of the principal curvatures is positive and the other principal curvature is negative. So it's in this upper quadrant, which means they look like saddle-shaped surfaces. The peak here is at is approximately equal to where the scale curvature, the curvature scaled by the surface area per unit volume is 1. So the surface area per unit volume gives a pretty good characteristic length scale of the curvatures in this structure. And the interesting thing that comes out of this, for example, that this is h equals 0, so these are surfaces that, for example, would be called, if it lied, if all the patches lied along this line, they would be minimal surfaces, which are surfaces that span all space but have zero mean curvature. And they would have the same chemical potential or same concentration as a flat interface because h is equal to 0. So any patch of interface along this line has the same chemical potential as a flat interface which lies down there. The only place where the Gaussian curvatures are positive are in these little regions over here, and that's where you have these pinching events, which I'll get back to in a second. If you do the same calculation for the non-conserved case, which is over here, and this is what you get for the Allen-Kahn case, if you stare at these things long enough, you'll be able to convince yourself that those are radically different structures. They're bicontinuous. This one's still bicontinuous, but I think you can see that the range of length scales you get in the interfaces here are very different than what you see over here. They're much more crenellated. The curvature distributions are much higher than the rather smooth cases that you see over here. And that is, in fact, reflected by these time-independent distribution functions. So this is what you get for the non-conserved case, this is what you get for the conserved case, and you have a much broader range in the curvature. So the maximum mean curvature for the Allen-Kahn case sits right about here in a deviation from h equals 0, whereas the non-conserved case, the Ginzburg-Landau case, it's a much, much bigger deviation. So the range of curvatures you get are much higher. Again, this is 50-50 a volume fraction of alpha and beta. So it stays at this state as a function of time, and the amount of alpha and beta don't change. It's still symmetric about h equals 0, as you'd expect, because it's 50% distribution, but there's a much broader range of curvatures in this case, so it's a much more complicated structure. So what happens when you do something that's not 50-50? So this is kind of an idealized case, right? You could never experimentally set up an order-disorder transformation or a magnetic ordering system that has 50% spin up and 50% spin down, or exactly, such that you get that system that I showed you. And this is what happens in 2D. So if you take a mixture, this is and the volume fraction of one of the phases is 48%, the volume fraction of the other is 52, you allow this to evolve in time, and it very, very quickly breaks up. It's no longer bicontinuous, and you end up with spherical, circular domains in this case that sit in the structure. And in fact, let me run this movie once more once it gets to the end. I want to point out what really is going on here. So watch this rather long stringy domain down here. So what's really happening is that this long stringy domain is just pulling in on itself rather than coarsening. So this stuff cannot remain bicontinuous because of the two-dimensional nature of the evolution problem itself. And so you end up with an inside phase, which is the 48% phase, and an outside phase, a black phase, which is the 52%.
Does the larger phase always remain the connected one?
Yes. Yes. That's right. The system seems to do that very quickly. So the question was exactly the one you asked. Well, what happens in three dimensions? And that's what happens in three dimensions. So you go to 36%. So this is way off 50%. And this is the kind of structure that you get. This is completely interconnected. It does not break up. It's completely bicontinuous. And it coarsens as a function of time, just as you'd expect. You can see that the structure looks different. It's more tubular-like. You can see there are these tubes that stretch through the structure, but it's completely bicontinuous. So two dimensions is a rather dramatic effect on the evolution of the structure. And what that means, the reason why it's bicontinuous, is that it can be interconnected out of the plane, basically, that you don't see in two dimensions. And so these are what the interface shape distributions look like. So at 50%, it's completely symmetric. 40%, it moves off a little bit. 36%, it moves off a little bit more. And you can see that you're beginning to produce more positive Gauss curvature here. In other words, more regions that have hemispherical-like tops to it than you do over here because you're shifting the volume fraction. The mean curvature is no longer, the average curvature in the structure where this peak is no longer at h equals 0. And you can see that it's becoming a little broader and certainly not symmetric even about this line anymore. So it does change the evolution. So the morphology of these bicontinuous structures still scale. You still see universality. But the shape of the universal distribution is a function of the volume fraction. So another way of characterizing these structures is by the topology of the structures. Rather than looking at the detailed interface shapes and the interface shape distributions, you can quantify them by measuring the topology. And a topology is a very general measure of what the shape of an object is. So, for example, a sphere and a cube and a pyramid all have the same topology because you can take a sphere and you can continuously deform it to a cube or to a pyramid without introducing any cuts. Whereas if you had a, you can tell I made this slide up early morning. This is a bagel or a coffee cup. These two things are topologically different because there's no way by a continuous deformation you can take a bagel or, since this is a physics audience, a torus, and convert it from this to that, okay, without cutting it. So this has something we call a genus of one. It has one handle. In fact, that's the terminology in the field. These are handles, whereas this is a genus of zero because it has no handles. And so we're going to quantify the topology of these complicated structures using this measure called a genus. And the genus is simply an integral of the Gaussian curvature over the surface. So Gaussian curvature has units of 1 over length squared times the area. So that has to be a dimensionless number divided by 4 pi, subtract from 1, and you get something called the genus. So it's a number of handles. So that's a genus of 0. That's a genus of 1. And bicontinuous structures is another interesting interpretation of the genus. And it's related to the number of branch points and the number of branches that come out of a branch of a particular branch. And so one of the way you want to think about this genus in these topologically complicated structures is the number of loops that you can take in the structure that takes you from one branch point to another. Okay? So it's the interconnectedness of the structure that we're measuring here. So how does the genus evolve as a function of time? So if you measure the genus per unit volume as a function of time, you know that the length of the structure, characteristic length, goes like t to the 1/3. The genus per volume is it goes like 1 over the volume or 1 over the length cubed, so t to the minus 1/3 cubed. So it should go like t to the minus 1, and that's in fact what we see in our simulations. So as coarsening goes on, the genus is changing. And how does the genus change? So how do you change the genus of a torus but breaking it apart? So you have these fissioning events that occurs during the coarsening process in these topologically complicated systems, and these fissioning events or pinching events is what allows the coarsening process to occur, and it scales exactly what you'd expect. But the surprise here was the value of this genus. So if you take the genus per volume, you scale by this characteristic length to give you something that's independent of length versus a characteristic length scale, 1 over S of V, and you put all of the data that we have. So this is 50% non-conserved. So these are the Ginzburg-Landau simulations, conserved of various volume fractions. You get the same genus of about 0.125 or so. And so what that means, what does 0.125 mean? That means that for a characteristic volume of 1 over S of V cubed of 1 over 0.25, you have one handle, okay? And you get the same genus regardless of what the volume fraction is and regardless of whether or not it's a conserved or non-conserved structure. So even though the morphology is very different, these phase-separating systems produce a unique value of the topology. And this topology is not the same for all interconnected structures. So for example, if you looked at the Schoen's G surface, this is from a triply periodic mean surface, minimal surface. So this is a surface that connects periodic at all edges here. The mean curvature is every place on this is equal to 0. Gaussian curvature is non-zero. But the genus of this structure per S of V cubed is 0.271, which would be all the way up here. So these phase-separating systems produces a topology that's different than these triply periodic minimal surfaces, but nevertheless it's unique and independent of many, whether it's conserved, non-conserved, or the volume fraction. And if anyone has any ideas of why this can be the case, I'd be interested in hearing from it, because we don't know at this point. We really don't know. So what happens if you continue to lower the volume fraction? Well, if you continue to lower the volume fraction, eventually the structure does not remain bicontinuous. At 30%, it breaks up, and you can see that you have spherical particles here and these very tubular-like domains. So someplace between 30% and 36%, this structure it will no longer be bicontinuous, but will break up into particles. And we didn't analyze this structure. But nevertheless, that's at least a one value for where it would break up. What I've shown you is the interfacial morphology of these structures. The last thing I'd like to talk a little bit about is the spatial correlations, because the problem with these interface shape distributions is that it's the probability of finding a patch of interface. And if you think about it, you have a probability function that tells you what the patches of curvature are in the system. It tells you nothing about how those things are distributed in space. So if I gave you an interface shape distribution with a certain probability distribution, you could not build up the bicontinuous structures I just showed you, because you wouldn't know how they're spatially correlated. So our first shot at looking at spatial correlations is inspired by what people do with systems with spherical particles or liquids, for example. You look at a radial distribution function as a function of position. So This is the probability of finding a particle at a given location in a spherical shell about a given chosen one. So you choose a particle, go out a certain distance, count the number of particles in a spherical shell, and normalize it by what you'd expect for the mean density, and you get a density profile that looks like this. So when they're very close, there are no particles, they're not touching. When they're very far away, you go to the mean density and it goes to 1, and then at short distances there's some sort of correlation. You can do the same thing for systems with these complicated curvature distributions. And what we do is we looked at the mean distributions of the mean curvature, because this is what drives the coarsening process. And we start off with a given dot here. This is our given patch. And we go out and we look at the curvatures, the mean curvature of the patches that surround a given patch. And we go out in units of 1/3 of the characteristic length. So let me show you what I mean by that. So we choose the little white dot here. And this is, the probability of finding a patch of interface with a given curvature H2 surrounding one of a given curvature H1. So we choose a value of H1, and you say, well, what kind of curvatures surround H1 near 0? It turns out there's high probability that the curvatures that surround H1 equals 0 also have H equals 0. Or the curvatures that surround H1 equals minus 1 also have minus 1. And basically what that says, if you look at this picture, it makes reasonable sense, right? These curvatures at very small distances are going to be relatively similar because the coarsening process would argue against that. The surface energy likes to smooth things out. This is not a fractal surface. And so the fact that the surface energy smooths things out implies that curvatures of one type in the neighborhood of another would be relatively smooth. But as you go out, those kind of curvature distributions change. So this is for the non-conserved structure. This is for the highly crenellated structure. As you go out to 2/3 of S sub V, you can see the change. These self-correlations are the fact that you have curvatures of the same value near each other, which is right along this dashed line here, beginning to decay. You have very high correlations out here, and these very high curvatures turn out to be the pinching events that I was talking about before. So we pick those up in the spatial distributions of the curvature. There, look at the regions over here. Curvatures of opposite sign are strongly anti-correlated. In other words, you won't find a positive curvature and negative curvature at very small distances to one another. And again, that's because of surface tension, right? You won't find these very wavy interfaces. They tend to flatten out. And so that's why you find these anti-correlations out at these distances out here. And as you go out in distance, eventually these things begin to decay towards the average, what you would expect from the mean density. So you still have these correlations, self-correlations of curvatures of the same sign at distances all the way out to 5/3 of S of V, so you're out to this shell. You still have anti-correlations existing. So again, the structure is smooth. But the question here is, why do you get these correlations all the way out at very long distances? Remember, these are these non-conserved structures. And the non-conserved structures, you have this very local evolution law. It says the velocity goes like the mean curvature at a point. So one interface doesn't know that the others exist, yet you see these correlations in the spatial correlations in the mean curvature out to distances of 2 times the characteristic length, the surface area per unit volume. So the question here is, why is that happening? And in fact, you don't get to the mean distribution or the average case until you go almost all the way out to 2 times the characteristic length. And the reason for this has to do with the fact that you have these tubes that connects regions of interface together. So by tubes, I mean these little regions here. You see examples right there is one. And for example, this looks like an hourglass-like shape. It connects one region of interface to another. These are colored by the mean curvature. So these have positive mean curvature. These have negative mean curvature. And in this region, you can see whenever you have a tunnel from one interface to another, the mean curvature has approximately the same sign. And so if you blow that up, you can see that these tunnels give rise to correlations between curvatures of the same sign. And that's what we were seeing in the in the spatial correlation plots. In fact, the distances between these tunnels, here's one with positive curvature, here's another one with positive curvature, is about 2 times the characteristic length. So what happens here, what we're seeing in the correlation plots, is that the phase separation process itself gives rise to rather long spatial correlations, not because of the way the interfaces move, but because of the bicontinuous nature of the structure itself, gives rise to these tubes of interface that give rise to correlations among curvatures of the same sign. If you look at the conserved structure, so this is the one where you have long-range diffusion. This is at various distances. N here is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. So this is 2 times the characteristic length. This is 1/3 of the characteristic length. Again, at small distances, the surface energy smooths things out. So you have high correlation between curvatures of the same value along this line. And as you go out, you can see that the curvatures remain anti-correlated, as I showed you before. But what happens very quickly, as you go out in distances, in this case, you notice the curvatures of opposite sign, negative curvature, positive curvature, become positively correlated at about 5/3 S of V. So what's happening here is that the diffusion process itself is changing the way the curvatures are distributed in the structure. And remember this, so this is a conserved case, so you have to have mass transport from one interface to another. And so what happens here is that curvatures of negative, for example, values are feeding mass to curvatures of positive values or vice versa. And so the mass flow itself, the fact the curvature has to material has to flow from regions of positive curvature to negative curvature, give rise to correlations between curvatures of opposite sign that you don't see in the non-conserved case. And these correlations continue to exist at longer distances. They disappear, and curvatures of the like sign reappear, so these are the tubes again. And then the curvatures of opposite sign become correlated at longer distances, and these things oscillate back and forth as you go out to long distances. So the upshot here is that the diffusional interactions between the interfaces introduces correlations in the curvatures. So this is, again, these structures colored by curvature. Positive curvature is negative. Positive curvature is red. Negative curvature is blue. And you can see the patches are relatively regularly distributed. In fact, if you look at this one, you can see you have positive curvature, 0, and negative, and the distance between those two is about 4/3 of S of V, which is what we're picking up in our correlation plots. So these interfaces are shrinking or growing or feeding mass to these interfaces, and this diffusional interaction takes place over a length scale that's about 4/3 of the surface area per unit volume. So what I've shown you is that in these topologically complicated structures, you can have scaling that gives you a unique interface shape distribution. In other words, you have a unique morphology of the interfaces. You can have bicontinuity as low as volume fractions of 30%. The morphology is a function of the volume fraction and whether or not the order parameter is conserved, but the topology is independent of these things. So it's the bicontinuous structures you get from phase separation give you the same topology or the number of rings in the structure. The bicontinuous structure itself introduces spatial correlations which are unique that we didn't know until we looked for these spatial correlations, and that the spatial correlations in the conserved case are affected by the way the interface evolves. In other words, whether it's by diffusion or local evolution by curvature. So thanks very much, and I'd be happy to answer questions.
Among many awards won by Professor Voorhees, there were research awards, but within the university, a large number of teaching awards. And you can see from his delivery, it is a pleasure to hear him talk. Questions?
Yes.
You ever heard of this mechanical structure called the plumber's nightmare?
I've heard of a plumber's nightmare. It's usually what happens in my house, however. But it's not.
It looks just like that. It's just a whole bunch of interconnected pipes, but with no
Are the pipes straight? Or do they actually meander?
You get it when you take the crystal phase, it would normally be a lamellar thing, and you put in some molecules that like to be curved.
So oh, I see.
So it doesn't coarsen, but it adopts a...
This is a very complicated structure. No, that's interesting. These bicontinuous structures are becoming more interest, for example, for photovoltaics, because of the high interfacial high surface area per unit volume. If you have photoactive reactions that occur along the interface, people are using these in polymer photovoltaics now, phase separated, for example. So they're becoming more of interest in applications as well. The Betty numbers are very much related to the genus. Yeah, that's another way of. Yeah, that's right. In fact, the because our structure is bicontinuous, the first Betty number is exactly equal to the genus minus one or something like that. So they're directly related. That's right. Yeah, and that's right. So if you had a system that was like in the 30% I showed you, where you had isolated particles and interconnected things, the Betty numbers give you more information than the genus. But in this case, since it's bicontinuous, it's essentially the same thing. Yes. Yeah. Right.
So, like the simulations were the periodic boundary conditions.
Yes, they were actually.
So, does that actually influence the fact that does that actually influence the tubular domain? Because I would imagine you get a rather different morphology.
Absolutely. That's a very good question. And in fact, we did the following calculation. So, rather than using periodic in all three dimensions, We took a small slab where we have periodic in two and non-periodic in the third. And so what happened is that you had the usual coarsening process, everything was going hunky-dory, until the length scale of the structure became on the order of the thickness of your computational domain. And then, lo and behold, you get tubes all perpendicular to that dimension. So that's exactly what happens. And you have to be very careful. That's one of the reasons why we had to do these enormous calculations in order to get the scaling, because you can see these finite size effects coming in even with periodic boundary conditions at the tail end of our simulation. So you need very big computation. That's a real effect. That's right. Yeah. Yeah.
What determines the lower limit of the water pressure?
Yeah, that's a good question, too. You know, the nice thing about not having a concrete answer is that you can kind of wave your hand and speculate about everything. But so what happens, so the one thought is that as you decrease the volume fraction, you go more and more towards a tubular-like structure. And as you go more and more like a tubular-like structure, the system becomes unstable to a Rayleigh-like instability that begins to split these things off. So our thought is that this might be related to the fact that as you stretch out these things, they become more and more tubular-like, which is, in fact, if you look at the... let me go back here. Okay. So you notice that as you decrease the volume fraction, you get more and more of these interface patches that have zero curvature, one of them. So these are tubular-like structures. So in fact, you're creating more of these tubes. And as you decrease the volume fraction, these tubes get longer and longer and then begin to break up. And they break up at somewhere between 36 and 30. We don't know exactly where it is.
So there's a volume fraction
of 39. It's also suspiciously close to the percolation limit for a uniform distribution of spheres, which is about 23%. So it's exactly what happens between here and here. The problem is that this calculation took about 2 months. And so it wasn't easy for us to do many calculations to get to really pin it down. My student wanted to graduate. Yeah. Yes. So this is like the standard two-point correlation function. Yeah, that's right. We, in fact, have done that, and the reason why I don't show it is that it's a relatively insensitive measure to the structure, because you're only measuring a two-point correlation, and it's really hard to see changes that we see when we use real space measures. But it's another nice way of characterizing structures and something that's easy to do since we're doing things in Fourier space. So, yeah.
And the other just quick question is, do you not have to
Right. Right. Yeah, that's because we're at a high temperature and our numerical methods are pretty good. So if you have a bad numerical method, if you started out at 50%, the system, the round-off error, discretization error, will become important and you'll go off 50% and go to 100% one phase. So the reason why I didn't show you the non-conserved cases with volume fractions different than 50-50 is that it almost instantaneously goes to one big ordered domain. And so we've chosen high temperatures just in the right place, and we can get these bicontinuous structures to exist. But in reality, you have to do something else to stabilize the structures, like put it in a magnetic field or something. Yeah. Yeah.
So you construct the interface by running noun,
or right.
Defining a point, like a half,
yeah.
And then backing out the
interface. Exactly right. Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, David Sralovitz, right.
Yeah, and they had the paper where they figured out
McPherson,
the
right.
Of,
yeah, von Neumann Mullins, right.
Could you or doesn't try to study this process by numerical simulation of that equation?
That's a good question. The.
You explained the question.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah, I knew what he was talking about, but I guess we were the only two. So. This has to do with a classic problem of grains. So in a grain structure, you have boundaries that fill all and that fill space that look something like this. So you can imagine this would be plant cells, or what have you. And the interesting thing about this structure, it's just like the Allen Kahn. The velocity to point at this interface is going to look like exactly as I drew here, like some constant times the mean curvature. So so the question was, is does this problem that McPherson and Sralovitz dealt with in three dimensions have some relation to the problem that I was dealing with, which was phase separation, because this motion law is the same. And the answer here is that if they in fact can apply their same results to ours, but it's kind of like a very uninteresting degenerate case, because the thing that makes this problem difficult is all the junctions and the discontinuities in the curvature that you have, because it's a grain structure. Here, everything is nice and continuous, and you basically can't say very much from that. So in principle, those same measures can be applied, these length scales that they talk about, but it's really applicable more to the cases where you have these difficult-to-handle singularities in the curvature at the corners, at the junctions, trijunctions and such. What do you mean by large scale?
Oh.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. So what Castillo Thornton has done with my collaborator on this is that she has taken these structures and tiled them with materials of different elastic constants and asked the question, what is the properties of a material that have elastic constants that are distributed in this bicontinuous fashion? And it's amazingly close to the optimal values that you get from zero mean curvature kind of structures, these minimal surfaces. So even the upshot of that, the interesting thing about that, is that you can actually produce these in reality where you cannot ever produce, say, from a phase separation process, you can't get zero mean curvature surfaces because they're unstable. So, in principle, you can get very interesting mechanical properties, and as I mentioned, in the solar cell business, the photovoltaic business, these are two polymers that produce the electrically active regions along the interfaces here, so that's another region that people are using, and they get highly optimal photovoltaics out of these complicated structures. And finally, people are using these as membranes. So, for example, if you could etch out one of the phases. Oh, let me give you a very practical example that you can go home and tell your kids about. This is the structure of Pyrex glass. Remember the Pyrex that doesn't break? So if you look at Pyrex glass, it is phase separated and looks exactly like this, with a glassy phase on the inside and a ceramic phase on the outside. And I was very, very excited about the fact that we were seeing these interconnected structures at 36%, and I happened to give the talk in a materials department from someone Corning Glass was sitting in the audience and said, well, we knew that back in 1964 when we were making Pyrex. And I said, well, I didn't know you was making Pyrex. So the bicontinuous structure in this case is very important because the cracks can't propagate through the glass. There's not a very long distance before it goes from the brittle phase to the glassy light phase and gives you very strong glass, for example.
Questions? Fantastic. Thank you.
Thank you very much.